Yeah, I'm gonna try to touch upon a few things which were challenged by Michael. We also discussed them yesterday. So start with, this is a simulated event, just on generator level, what you can expect at 200 pileup, and this is just particles above 1 GeV. But that's not so impressive compared to this, which is actually, that took me 3 days of my work, full out stretch on. This is a recorded event, which we had in Atlas in the first week, of, I think second day even, of heavy iron collision running, where we had a very fortunate chance to see a pileup event there, and that is 15,000 reconstructed tracks in the tracker. And this is not even the environment we will have with mu 1000. This is easy to compare to mu 1000 environment. So I'm gonna. What do you say? This is a heavy iron event with a trick reconstruction we run for heavy iron, where we force everything into one vertex because that makes it easier to do. But. Okay, this is a double central lead-lead collision. Let's go to this very quickly, but that's not really what I will talk about the timescales. And not also about 100 kilometers and 100 TV, because that answer whether it's 100 or 80, I think a good fraction to the 100 is the fact that we have 10 fingers. So I think we shouldn't discuss that too much, but we should probably discuss how feasible this is.
When do you get this timeline?
I got this timeline from the FCC Rome week, from Phil Alpert's slide. Yeah. So exactly. So this is this is the timeline I got from that is sorry, that's FCC. Yeah, I'm sorry. That might be the that says FCC. Good. Good to do that. But what I rather would like to talk about is the experimental challenge, and I think for us that have to kind of work on the FCC HH detector and performance studies is what we need to do to kind of prove the assumptions that go into the physics reports. And of course, one is the increase of energy, which we have, and then we discussed this actually yesterday, what the magnet strength has to be. I think 33 needs to have higher magnets. This was the small discussion we had. What is very interesting for experimentally for this is the change in the phase two of the FCCHH, which is not clear whether one can run with a 5 nanosecond or 25 nanosecond bunch spacing. That makes a different, very, very different scenario in terms of the pileup, which is around 1,000 or stays around 200, which is a regime where we probably would be already very experienced from the HLLHC. So depending whether you ask someone with preference for a tracking detector or a calorimeter, you get very different answers what is preferable, of course, on this.
But Andy, that change is only important if the detector has a time resolution sub 5 nanoseconds.
Correct.
It's integrated anyway.
Correct. So if you ask from a tracking perspective, 0.5 nanosecond bunch spacing is not a problem at all to deal with. To read out, to receive, of course. Correct. Of course. Correct. So if you start from the plain soft QCD or min bias picture, there's not such a big jump from 14 to 100 in the cross section in number of average particles per rapidity unit in average particles. So it's really something which is not the difficulty to deal with. So this gives quite some confidence that you start with LHC like detectors is the right like starting point. Yeah? But if you start collecting what we want to achieve, and thanks to Mike, he has actually done quite some good motivation on that in the talk before, is if you want to reach something like a 15% PT resolution at 10 TeV, motivated by searches, for instance, And the calorimeter resolution for digest searches, etc., with certain targets, that will shape us how the detector will look like. So this is probably what I will talk a little bit. But then an additional ingredient to putting like the wish list of things we would like to have the detector from the physics point of view is also the larger ITER coverage, which is not entirely new because this is already both in the ATLAS and CMS upgrade program for phase two that we would like to look into extending at least the tracker acceptance up to 4. I think it's now common sense that this is tried to be done. Here, for instance, to capture, of course, the different pseudo-rapidity or rapidity spectrum in WH. But that requires, on the same time, that all our reconstruction and understanding goes out to this, like p-tagging, c-tagging, etc., etc. While, as Mike said, still maintaining low PT trigger threshold. So that's quite a wish list to this. And this is just one of the GN4 simulations. I think, yeah, that's a C prime into QQ, where you can see, of course, we're looking into, start looking into this in particular also to see what is needed for a containment, or does a shower containment work in, for instance, here with 12 lambda zeros. So, what if you go away and don't look only at the energy increase, but basically look into your environment increase, you have to deal with something I might not be the full expert on, which is the radiation and requirements for the detector. So here's certainly some work to be done. There's quite some significant increase in the radiation compared to what you'd expect at HHLHC. So there is certainly also constraints from the technological pathway. But so the starting point for the baseline FCC-HH detector was CMS and ATLAS, and then given the constraints on the PT resolution and some reasonable estimates, the first thing to be done was a scale up of these systems into something that is mainly given by the necessary size of the coil for the PT and the containment of showers in the HCAL. And from that, the next step was basically a sort of refinement. Looking back, I can say that as an ATLAS person, certainly the main reason for the ATLAS standalone muon system was a pure fear that the tracker would not work with the pileup, and so the standalone tracker in the muon system could recuperate the muon standalone tracking. This, however, now we know better. We can really work within the current pileup scenarios. So that was, to my mind, I would say, pretty much overscaled. On the other hand, if you scale up the CMS detector just to boundaries here, you will end up with something which has an a really expensive and massive iron structure in the immune system to have to act as a return yoke. And that would be very expensive and probably not necessary if you go ahead and do an active shielding, which is the baseline design now. So this is what it looks like in the scratch book, basically, which a huge primary solenoid at 6 meters that covers the inner tracker and the ECAL and the HCAL, about 6.5 Tesla strength. Then an air-filled muon system with a chamber-like structure, but then you need an active shielding, so this is the twin solenoid solution, how it's called, that you have an outer solenoid which acts as the active shielding, and then to extend in the forward region with the dipole system, I'll talk about this a little bit, to then support basically tracking and calorimetry and muon tagging in the forward. So, and then of course there's these obvious ones you go through, detector design, you want to have it hermetic, etc., which I will not cover too much about. So the magnet system is probably the most impressive feature with this inner coil, and I put just the details down, we can discuss this, probably not too interesting to go into very detail. And the dipoles in the forward, which gives you a strength in a field map in the tracker, where you have basically very CMS-like but scaled up magnetic field, very homogeneous, and then you have has to be material-free regions in between, otherwise it does not make too much sense here, and a dipole field in the forward to get momentum measurement in the forward. So there's a lot of very detailed calculations. In particular, one can imagine that the design like this is also prone to quite some intrinsic forces. So the design of this dipole system has to be very carefully thought of to make it force and torque neutral. So there's quite a lot of design. Though, however, in the last, also in the FCC Rome week and follow-up meetings, there is now a second option of this, which seems to become favored by quite a lot of people, myself included, is to exchange the dipole system with a conical solenoid, which has to be balanced with a small solenoid here, in order to make the field more homogeneous and easier to deal with, but also technologically, I think, easier. Now, I found these two plots, unfortunately, and this compare the two systems, unfortunately one is in Tesla meter and one is in Tesla meter square. So it's not only that you have to take the square root between these two to compare, which in my head I can't do, you also have to fold it, since this is pseudo-rapidity, with the length you go through the through a volume. So whoever can do that in his head gets a real bonus point from me. I can't. What I can do, though, is compare these two, and that's what happened. So this is the test detector which has been put in now into this available space, based in the central with a CMS detector like layout. Actually, using the CMS program for this is an analytic tool called TK Layout, which has been put in there and extended to work also with typos. And from there, you can, with analytic calculations for the impact parameter and the momentum resolution, basically look what you can achieve. It's quite a conservative estimate here to look for, or to assume 3% per layer radiation length, which has been put there. Sorry, this is the radiation length. This, however, is the input for your resolution in the tracker, which is given by the intrinsic resolution and the material, and this affects basically differently a little bit the momentum and the IP. This is just a bit for reference. But for backing up the study, to at least one of the studies shown by Mike before, which requires the 10% momentum resolution or transverse momentum resolution at 10 dB, that seems to be possible. And also here, what can be shown is that the dipole and the solenoid option is very similar. This is analytical, so a bit of grain of salt, but all of the design studies, it's quite a simple thing to go to momentum resolution in a tracker. The resolution assumptions for the actually modules are very reasonable. 25 micrometers with the spinner used for this is something which is certainly absolutely no problem. 5 micrometers is no problem. We can achieve that now in the LHC. Below that doesn't make too much sense because you will hit the constraint how well you align your detector. So at some point you're limited. Now, one challenging quite a little bit the Mike's statement that the high PT physics will not be entirely the problem. I also think we can resolve that. But in both or in all systems, very collimated systems, booster jets, towers, is a difficult problem to resolve. At some point, you will hit your detector resolution, and then you can go further with that by using smarter techniques, like a neural network clustering we have deployed. So this is certainly one challenge, but the main challenge for the tracker will be resolving the pileup, and I'll come to that a little later. The event activity itself we have shown to with lead-lead collisions to be able to run with, because if you look at the far end of centrality heavy iron collisions, they kind of resemble the activity you expect at mu 200. So this is something where we can say we can run it. There's a price to pay, which is the CPU time at the moment, which I can show also. If we extrapolate that to mu 1000, then that's a different story.
You can't run it at 5 nanoseconds.
Yes. Yeah.
The fact that you can the ions orbit attacks come from the same point
helps. It helps from a CPU point perspective, but otherwise the local densities you have in the tracker, in the calorimeter, from the general activity from Pylab is an order of magnitude lower than what you have in dense jets, or even more. If you go to higher energy, it's the general problem of the Pylab is the solving of the combinatorics. Whether it comes from one point or from many is not really an issue. But you still have to invest in the time somehow to understand what you are looking at. The other problem is the local density of boosted objects. That's something you need smarter solution and not more time. At least that's how I see it. I'll come to that, because I think it's an important point which is very often forgotten, that in this scaling up we kind of assume that we can scale easily all the components, and I'm not sure we can do it without doing a lot of R&D also on that. Well, I come to that later once I'm through the detector. There probably what to say is, of course, the environment gives also a radiation challenge from that perspective. So here's a lot of studies that can be done and are done with Fluca that look actually at doses, and this is then the benchmarks for the development of the electronics, not only of the tracker. Of course, you see that goes throughout the detector. For the
Let's put that back for a second.
Yes, sure. So this is a readout rate calculation based on this former detector shown, and
I was trying to get at the trying to read the if it's red then it's at 10 to the 19. I mean, is that just the one beam line, or does that go through the inner layer of the pixels?
No, that's the front part of the calorimeter.
Okay, but it's also supposed to go all the way. What is the neutron equivalence at the innermost layer?
Oh, it's low. It's probably 10 to the 17. It's almost tolerable.
That's 3.7 centimeters. So, and it's the
yes.
Going down a little bit more, it goes at 3.2.
But the problem with the forward calorimeter is because of all the pile up, it's low PT stuff. It just hits it. All the crap that you don't care about.
You don't have to zoom on this plot.
I do not have the zoom on the plot. I can have a look if it's in the original reference I took.
You get like 10 to the
18. Yeah.
You do get that.
Depending on how close you want to get, but you can't get the 10 to the 18, which is, you don't know how to pull
the average. Well, it's not, this is one of the things, the innermost layer question of a detector like this is not as trivial as you might think, because as we discussed with the B-tagging before, if the majority or start a big bunch of your B-hadrons decay anyway after the, you know, you need to put more into consideration into this. I'm gonna go a little quicker, but just to give you the outline a little bit on the detector. So from the calorimetric system, the space is within the primary solenoid, and gives you the dimension here. What's probably interesting to notice is that the forward calorimeter will sit 25 meters away from the interaction point, which is already quite a distance. Now here in front, of course, in this sketch, there's the planning of having tracking chambers to then allow again particle flow, track to cluster matching, etc. So this is certainly something you will have to have there to do that. We can discuss a little bit the electromagnetic calorimeter, where the depth itself is not such a big increase for the hadronic calorimeter. It can be shown that 30 radiation lengths is enough. Atlas is 22, and CMS must be something at 25. If I take the crystal length over the X0, I think that, yeah, so it's not really a massive increase. However, due to the highly boosted objects, there will also be a very high granularity needed. So if you take a CMS, the CMS crystal size, which is hopefully correct, you're not yet there. That gives you 0.01. It's 21 millimeters in delta phi over 2.5 meters, gives you 0.01. So basically, it's almost there with this in the electromagnetic. For the EM calorimeter, you certainly need to deal with the pileup, and there, if you have a high timing resolution, that can of course help a lot. When there's studies ongoing in here. And then what proved to be useful is also the rather good pointing resolution to the vertex, particularly if you think of Higgs to gamma-gamma. One very interesting feature with such a strong magnet is of course that if you look at even the bending of a 20 GeV particle in that system, then by construction, any electromagnetic clusters that stem from Bremsstrahlung are very likely not to end up in the same cluster. So this is something where you need to have particle flow techniques, etc. So again, the broader look of reconstruction and not a subsystem reconstruction that is later on combined is, I think, something which one really needs to deploy in this scenarios. For the HCAL, we discussed this. Mike discussed this a little bit before. The studies here that have been done is cover mainly the thickness needed to contain the showers. So if you think of a 130 TV jets, then about 8% of the single hadron constituents have 1 TV, and you need self nuclear interaction length as shown here to basically contain this. So this is the study done. You basically see that you, with a total thickness of 12, you start this a little bit blurry, but you see that you contain 98 of percent of these constituents in the calorimeter, which is needed. And then similar to what we discussed before, in terms of substructure resolving, that gives some constraints on the cell sizes. So this is a 0.0. We discussed this in the break before. 0.01 would be a great separation. I think studies done so far have assumed this, if I took this number correctly. And then, of course, since this term is highly suppressed, you will have to work really on getting the constant turn as low as possible. So this is the target values which are taken for this. For the muon spectrometer to finish it, or muon system in that sense, what the assumption here is, since both, I think, the calorimetry and the tracker, the B tagging, etc., require a working tracker to be really at this peak performance, one can go away from the Atlas type of reconstruction where you have a standalone muon reconstructed as a track and a standalone muon reconstructed in inner tracker and combine these, but construct the muon system more as a tagger, but with the capability of have a rather precise angle measurement in order to achieve a good momentum resolution. And this has been tried out as well, basically defining the size of the system. And you can see that this is without the dipole, but you see basically, again, analytic studies, but they are to my mind really good enough for this, that you can see that if you take a tracker and muon only, you can achieve extremely good resolutions that then fall off here. This is because there's no forward dipole, so this has been updated, of course, now with the either forward dipole or conical solenoids. A few remarks here, of course, is that this tagging from inner tracker found muons to outer muon station hits needs to be rather robust, and with a mu 1000 this is probably not entirely trivial, because the combinatorics will be rather quite difficult, and since you have a really massive block of material in between, the nice feature of a muon to look as a perfect almost Gaussian behaving particle in terms even of energy loss may vanish, because you're prone to catastrophic energy loss, etc. So challenges, but something which is not too worrisome. Where we have to put quite some work into is to deal with this entry in the table, which is the increase in the pileup, and this is the point, I think, where from the real performance studies have to back up the numbers that are put into the physics performance studies, and as the matter is, of course, these take quite a long time. So not only the studies to be performed or the simulations to be performed, it would be, I think, naive from my point of understanding to assume that the algorithms and the concepts we use right now for mu 5068, which was peak in run one, can just be reused at mu 1000. So I think there needs to be also some algorithmic development. So let's talk a little bit about pileup, and since we heard it yesterday, or the day before yesterday, well, you did so well with LHC. Everyone was afraid of the pileup, and then it was actually not such a big problem. That is true. That is a good statement. Whether the extrapolation to mu 1000 is also true is a not so trivial statement, I would say. So to give you this in picture, this is the design 21 or 23, I don't remember exactly what it was, as an average pileup for the LHC, and this is the peak number interactions. So the peak interactions have exceeded it quite a lot. There was one very high luminosity run, a special run at the end of run one, which is out of here. It reached 68 peak pileup, which was a very good test run, of course, in preparation for the experiments, and something very good to learn from. And we have done remarkably well in run one, and now also run two. As I said before, the lead-lead collisions have been a really good test bed, actually, to test this. This is just showing the stability of the tracker, for instance, going from standard or from very non-central to central events in lead-lead collisions, which shows you basically the detector is working, the reconstruction is working for the tracker. And then similarly, if not more impressive, I would say, is the summed up energy, if you take the CMS tracker in the particle flow algorithm, and you do you look basically what's the energy in a unit area in the tracker, and you would just take a cone algorithm, of course, with the number of vertices you reconstruct, this kind of explodes. But if you take a particle flow algorithm, you see that you stay at the perfect flat performance. So of course that is a nice fit to extrapolate to 1,000. Yeah, whether it does is a different question. I would say though it's a good slope to extrapolate for. Last 5 minutes. Yeah, I will talk about the challenges I see in some more areas which are not just sometimes a bit forgotten. One is the data and Monte Carlo production at this rate, and that is a CPU challenge. And what I want to show here is basically one thing that although in run one the event simulation, the vector simulation was the most CPU intensive problem to solve. We have seen in run one analysis where the dominant or part of the systematic error that became dominant was due to missing Monte Carlo statistics, which one can ask, is this a good analysis? Do you need the Monte Carlo that much? But there are analyses that have a significant fraction of Monte systematic error saying we don't have enough Monte Carlo. That, however, the simulation timing versus pileup is somewhat what flattens out, except for the signal. The signal goes like this, but if you do reuse the event, that's a problem that has a rather good timing behavior. The reconstruction with pileup is something that explodes due to the combinatorics. Two words about the simulation. Just to give you the idea what I wanted to say, so like a standard Monte Carlo campaign for the LHC takes 10 to the 9 events. That's billions of events is somewhat what a Monte Carlo campaign 2015 off CMS is about. Also, some precision analysis, at least the BSAP S mu mu in Atlas, require themselves at the order of 10 to the 9 events to control the background. If you take that, a full simulation event takes about 5 minutes, or the order of 5 minutes at the moment to do, particularly in Atlas with this calorimeter, you can do the math how much computing you need. And if you want to scale it up to mu 1000, that is something which is a bit scary. We don't have to do everything with full simulation, but I'll skip that. I'll just tell you that within the efforts of the FCC software community, we actually plan to put this idea that we have full simulation, fast simulation, basically everything running alongside, and you can use optimal, what's best for you for your analysis given the statistics. We plan to put that into the initial design of the software. From the reconstruction challenges, and now this is what I want to say, where the pure scaling on extrapolation to 1000 mu is not that trivial, is some lessons learned from how we deal with high pileup events in the tracker. And what you see here, and I'll make the point hopefully quite clear soon, is the number of tracks reconstructed with the pileup. And you see what you would expect, of course, is a linear behavior. So everything which is non-linear means you're picking up fake combinatorics. So if you have a deviation from a linear increase here, as you see here, you start building up tracks from random hits, and that is of course harmful for your analysis. So there's a way to mitigate that, which is by making the requirements for a good track tighter. But that is something that will harm basically all the special reconstruction analysis we've been talking about. That is more like stop tracks will be difficult to find. If you say we require complete tracks with many hits, you will harm immediately your signal on stop tracks. Late vertices or late decaying particles will be difficult to find, because you will with these tight requirements, the controller look at the smaller radii. So this is something where there has to be a lot of work done to, I think, support also the experimental reconstruction side of view. One other thing which happens, which you see here again, this is the number of pileup events, is the number of vertices. Naively, of course, you would expect linear correlation, but what you see here, either you take reconstruction release 20 or 20, whatever, is you see merging and shadowing effects. So the vertices become closer and closer, and at some point they are not resolved anymore. So you start deviating from this, and this is why this goes. We're here at 40, so if you extrapolating this to 1,000, this effect will be massive. Yeah. Yes, here we go. No, this is my naive. This is what I did this morning because I thought this is my naive calculation. Okay, very naive. If and I took this also from the Rome week, if we take a bunch length of 8 centimeters or 8 millimeter and we look at it very naive and say the optimal bunch structure is a box and not a Gaussian. It's just a box and they are uniquely distributed over this. Then. If you take the RMS, that goes back to about 300. That shouldn't be 200. That shouldn't be meters. I'm really sorry. 277 millimeters. So this is also the design range for the phase two detectors. You get to average vertex separation of 270 microns. Very naive. Yeah. If you look at this is the plot at 13 TeV. If you look at take random vertices in the event, this is how you can measure the effect of vertex merging. And you look at the differences. You start seeing this dip, which basically means vertices get merged. There's a little bit of splitting going on, but this is something where at that point. Probably you can resolve it in for high multiplicity vertices, but for signatures that have no high PT objects pointing to the vertex, you will have a problem. So Higgs to gamma will have a problem identifying the vertex. So we will rely on the pointing capabilities of the calorimeter probably. But that kind of needs to be folded in because here you hit a limit which you can not easily resolve, because if you want to pick up the soft QCD vertices as well, the resolution of those is by definition rather bad because you have soft tracks. You can say I don't care about it, but then you start harming all vertices that don't have a high Q-square object pointing to them. So we discussed this, two slides, now I'm done. Two slides, which is boosted B hadrons. This is going to happen. It happens already, and I'm not entirely sure if we know whether we modeled that well enough, that the B hadron actually decays after the first or even second detection layer. And if it's a charged particle and you don't have the readout to see what is the DEDX in the silicon, it's just yet another hit. So it becomes very difficult to see what their vertex or not. If you can identify that the hits in the first two layer, if you can associate them from that there's a B hadron that deposited the energy, that helps. You need to start exploiting these things, yeah.
So I know that the upgrade DX is being modeled by Parker. Yeah. The current
But you have so Atlas also went down for the IBL already from an 8-bit analog readout to 4-bit. So you have 4 bits left to measure the charge deposit in your pixel rather than 8. And then that is already little discrimination power you have. Yeah? And of course it's a stochastic process, so one measurement doesn't really tell you anything. Yeah. Final final worry. The final worry is the extrapolation at the moment of CPU time, which is really worrisome and something we also need to think of for a FCC environment. The CPU time is mainly driven by the inner tracker reconstruction, which is combinatorial and is unfortunately highly nonlinear, which you can see here. This is already after the experiments have done a massive campaign in the first shutdown to cut down the CPU time. I think both reached a factor 4, which is probably not so easy to redo in the same way. That is not something you want to scale up to 1,000. Yeah? However, there is, of course, a lot of progress in computing, but that needs a lot of R&D also to think differently. Moore's law did stop, so the processor speed does not go up. One has to think differently in programming, etc. So this is something where basically R&D is needed. We are at the moment trying to do like a machine learning challenge.
Yeah. The cost, I mean, presumably the way that industry will get around that is by massive parallelization, right? So
correct, correct. Correct. But it's not a miracle to say, if you look at the current high energy physics reconstruction code and you check for its parallelization capabilities, they are basically zero. So that is what I meant. You need to invest also here in R&D, start how do I, in a parallel structure.
So the other thing is power consumption per unit cycle.
Oh yes, true.
No, seriously, I mean, just kind of just
the SSE to
yeah.
You just don't have, you melt your mainframe basically, you have that much power going in, even if you could pack it all in and you could afford it. So really, it's the next level of concern.
They are central serial. They are central.
It's largely because people don't want to rewrite things.
Right? Exactly.
Right. So for this project, I think that right. you would do it the right way.
No, but the other thing is that in hardware, you could remove the number of costs. Hardware, and just increase the granularity, put it in pixels instead of strips. So extrapolating apples results
yeah.
40 years from now.
It's certainly not fair, no. But it shows that also in this area there has to be R&D. You have to. And it's serious work. It's not.
It's
yeah.
Serious
yeah. Yeah.
And don't forget also that maybe it's folded in or not. But I mean, the idea will be you're doing tracking into the calendars as well. Like, highly. The amount of tracking information
will be lost.
There is a challenge there.
I'm at the conclusions. As you hopefully have seen, we are advancing in the detector studies starting from a baseline design, and I guess that's exactly the way to go. You have your constraints from the physics studies to say, can we reach a resolution of that, can we, etc. So this is the start of the baseline. Of course, the pile-up environment of 1,000 will be challenging. So it needs a lot of R&D. Also, a fair point to make, if the high Lumia LHC will be just a perfect step point for a lot of this development, both on the hardware and on the algorithmic reconstruction set.
But I'm confused, where the 1,000 comes from? I mean, if you want to have essentially...
It's keeping 25 nanoseconds.
Yes, yes. That is keeping the 25 nanoseconds.
So on the accelerator side, what's the main... obviously, I understand better what the 5 nanosecond challenges will be for the detectors, but on the accelerator side, what do they, the machine people, worry about with getting to 5?
I can only say, I think, from the difficulties in end of run one to go from 50 to 25, that was basically a not really controlled electron cloud. Yeah, but okay,
that should not be the same. It should be different.
Yeah.
It should be very different material, different things, right? 25 or 50 nanosecond has to do with the time constant of re-emission and then getting into the beam. That's very specific to the geometry. There's no reason to believe it should just get worse.
Okay.
It could get worse, but there's no obvious reason why it should, how it should scale.
How much better we assume to get them? well, if you want to run at 5 nanoseconds, you need to resolve that. That is which then opens a lot of possibilities, because if you have a tracker, for instance, with extremely precise timing information, then you open up a new dimension for your track compatibility fit, which is perfect. Yeah, which is perfect. At that moment, things that we do right now to tighten the track requirements to distinguish between combinatorial and fake or not can become way easier, because you have an additional handle on it. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
That wasn't done in your studies.
So that wasn't done. No, that was not done, because.
But can you benefit from the timing in terms of the just identifying collisions, several collisions within the same bunch process, or bunches too short? You know, you need that?
I think you can identify primary vertex for the very forward.
Forward, yes.
It's just by using timing, so you know the time of the main interaction from the IPT tracks, and then you just remove the ones which come earlier or later.
But well, if we get to, I mean, there's a large decision.
No, I understand, but what was the bunch size?
Is
the bunch size?
It's 8, what, this was like, luminous region is plus minus 15
so
centimeter.
No. Yeah, then you benefit a lot from kind of things at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's quite likely on this time scale that this RMD is being run for picosecond timing detectors.
Plus, there is quite some upgrade program as well on the phase two to test first of these detectors. Yeah.
They may not make it to phase two, but they would probably.
Yeah. One thing is that they would achieve the whole track, but again, because they already picosecond would be
Yes.
In the pattern recognition, you could start to use time. If you had it at every layer,
things.
What I'm saying is that transverse size of the beam doesn't matter for time. That's totally invisible.
Right? Not even the same thing. The things that are happening on one end or the other and happen at different times.
Right.
That's the order of 100 or 200 picoseconds.
I mean, you should just take the time of the bunch collision. So if you have 15 centimeter, bunches, that's half a nanosecond, right? The Gaussian, so take, I don't know, 0.2 nanoseconds, and then divide it by your resolution, so you would decrease the pile up by that factor. What do you
think? It does work in the radial direction.
Yeah, but you don't need to have timing everywhere. You need just basically get the timing of the tracks in general, right? So.
No, but he, I mean, what he was. The vertex separation was not the big issue. He's worried about more about time required to reconstruct the track.
But that is completely different.
It's a different
problem,
thing.
And it could be done by degaussing and optimizing the layers to the role of speech.
It's a different problem. You could solve, that's the traditional way to solve it, but if because of the precision timing R&D, you had a 4D construction, then you would do.
Yeah, and you remove those by timing.
Yeah, sure.
Kind of, when I was a graduate student, people were still doing, well, postdoc too, and people were still doing Kickstarter experiments where you really have a limited trigger. You select a very small subset of data and look for the most exciting events. And there may be a time when the thing we're looking for with this type of machine, and the cross section is so small, we just have to jack up the luminosity. In that case, you really probably need to think about how to develop the trigger and how to really use all the intelligence to figure out how to look for these events instead of really trying to write everything down and try to do generic study and having thousands of topics to look for. And if technology doesn't keep up and we still want to look for these events and somehow accelerator does advance to the level that we think have the kind of lost. So perhaps we can also think in that scenario, at least we can look for things running high velocity without really, you know, just write everything down. For example, the track density going outwards and is probably getting better and better, and if you have a, you know, high PT, muon pairs, some sort of a signature, and in principle you look inward, and if you have a beast traveling 30, 40 centimeters away from the IP, and the kind of the thinking, the paradigm would be very different, and we probably need also to think smart ideas and also matching the most exciting physics to the detector features and patterns and topology and so on and so forth, and to be event specific and without burdening the computing, the reconstruction, the simulation. So perhaps we can look that way also.
Let me, there's two things to this story. Yeah? I agree that we spend a lot of time, obviously, this is a trivial observation. We spend a lot of time in a high pileup machine to reconstruct things to then discard them. Because otherwise we don't know that we can discard them. Like you reconstruct the entire event, and then you are interested in your five objects. Let's do that. However, on the trigger, at least now for phase two, a lot of the like the concepts, at least as I would see that, are even opening up, look more at global event triggers again. If you look at these concepts of pattern banks or CMS L1 track trigger, they are really triggering on objects in the entire event. So it's of course then topologically combine them to something you look for. If you can do that in the hardware, it's of course great, and then you have the entire school of basically no trigger but reconstruction on the fly, read out the entire detector, which is more towards Alice is doing.
Yeah, I want to add something to this point and then I had a question.
What you say is in principle correct, but may apply to a very specific search or object that you're looking for. The point is that there is an infinite set of objects that you may be looking for. Because a priori, you don't know what is that would be interesting. And that is what multiplies somehow the trigger, you know, the trigger speech. What I'm saying is just an individual trigger that may be staying at 49 tiles, for example. And that by itself is a very low bandwidth. But then you want thousands of viewers, you want photos, you want photo many tiles, you want this and that. automatically becomes very broad. And you're forced to write out a huge amount of dates because for different analysis you think it's important. So that is the issue.
The comment I wanted to make is on the issue of the forward coverage. I'm still not 100% convinced that it's so absolutely crucial. Typically we motivate it out of two physics scenarios. One is tagging forward jets for vector boson fusions, for instance. And the other one is acceptance for the Higgs. You also have tables, right? So if the Higgs goes to four leptons, and obviously you want to get acceptance. Now, the first case is probably the most compelling one, because indeed BBF, the forward jets, only go in the forward. There is nowhere else where you can gain. So I think that is interesting. On the other hand, it's jets. So one thing is to be able to see jets, a kind of emitter, and one thing is to be able to do tracking and tagging. It's different scales. When it comes to acceptance, I mean, I looked at this, and you gain infinitely more by lowering your thresholds by just a few GV in the central region than by extending by one unit of rapidity before.
But at what rapidity BBF jets peak at this energy?
Sorry?
At what rapidity BBF jets peak at this energy?
About I'm not talking about, I'm not talking about the jets. Exactly. I'm talking about Higgs to four lambda, for example, or Higgs to gamma gamma, whatever. What I'm saying is that you gain maybe 20-30% in acceptance at fixed PT going forward, but you can gain a factor of two by just going down by a few GV.
No, that's for sure. But I think I disagree with your statement that you only need calorimetry for EVM jets, because that's what we are looking at right now for the CMS upgrade, where we have high granular calorimeter in the ground in the forward region to tag BBM jets. Without tracking, it's really, really hard.
One thing is tracking, meaning saying that there is a track going through, and one thing is doing
that. That's what you're doing. His first reason he said was BBM, and he said, and you agree.
No, but I thought
the acceptance, none of us think is a good idea.
No, I thought for BBM you meant that it's enough to have a calorimeter.
I think that's also different saying that you want to do the physics of the BBF jets that requires tracking and many other information, but for example, it doesn't require B-tagging.
Of course,
The argument is one could think of making the forward system, I don't have it, way less elaborated.
Yeah. For example, trying to get that same 10% momentum resolution at 8.06, which is good luck.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So you have to be able to give up something.
Yeah.
But what's the peak of the BBF jets and repeatedly at this energy? Is it about four?
It's like 5 or 6.
Oh, right, five.
You certainly need to
that the depth has become smaller, so they're progressively cheaper.
But is that something that's driving the placement of the forward system? So you're getting the larger arm?
Yes. This is the...
Yeah.
So the other remark also is that even if you want to do BBF, one of the things that I showed the other day is that there are huge rates for Higgs production, pretty much all of the production channels or decay channels, and in particular BBF, if you require the Higgs to be at a large PT, becomes the dominant production channel for the Higgs. And therefore, all of the subtleties that we have to go through, jet tagging, etc., to single out BBF at the LHC, you don't have to at 100. So even that, we should take a close look at what is really needed, whether we really need it, because we could give up a factor of 2 or 3 or 4 in statistics and still be able to do BBF physics with just slightly different kinematics. If you move the
Higgs,
the jets will be boosted as well.
Has anyone looked at a simple thing? So imagine you don't detect jets beyond 5. You put a hole in your detector, right? So BBF jets give you huge missing ET, whereas normal interactions wouldn't give you much missing ET because the solid nature is so small. So you could, in principle, tag BBF by missing ET.
The missing ET is big, it's not immense. I mean, prognosis. But yeah, no, that's the point. Many things can be done. So before we get started, we absolutely need to be
No, because that makes the design that drives the design to be so complex. Yeah, I mean, it's already a good step, I'd say, from the dipole double dipole solution to this to the conical solenoid. That looks at least an easier setup. But it's true, if that can be, because it's one part, of course, to draw them in a little sandbox with the components like this. So then actually, is that a realistic scenario? So if there's not such a strong case for the similar bending power for the momentum resolution in the forward, that will make the system look easier.
I think it's worth it to take a hard look at this, because the tendency is, it's like if any of you have done a curriculum development in the physics department. We only add courses, right? We never say you don't. So we go back to, we start with Newton and we add. So if we only add coverage and add detectors, I mean.
Point taken. Yeah. Point taken.
So I just want to follow up on Michelangelo. I completely agree about the BPF stuff. I think, you know, the thing that in there is going to be a little more careful, because the pileup is actually worse in terms of the impact. Just the stochastic fluctuation can easily give you a BPF jet, quote unquote BPF jet.
No, but that is basically the same as the pilot does the LHC, so.
It's worse because it's thousand.
No, but if you go to 5 nanoseconds and drop by 10 to 5, so then you become more or less.
Only if you have a timing calorimeter. At the trigger level, then you're talking about not the reconstruction level.
Well, triggering on BBF jets might be tough. You might have to trigger in the central system, right? Yeah,
but if you don't trigger on it, then you're not gaining the full benefit of what you want to do.
A lot of times you won't count.
And people also talked about doing basically a software trigger, effectively getting data off it. And one of the slides, I guess you did not copy, from FCC, people made estimates of the data rate coming out of the detector. And that is an absolutely daunting number. The rate is more than today's aggregate worldwide wide area net. Don't look at local area network, but the wide area network, the worldwide WAN bandwidth. We will need more than that. Just to get the data off the detector.
Oh, by then, you know, people will stream so many movies that would be so.
Well, compared to today's number, but it's still a very, very impressive number.
Okay, I think we can. There are a lot of. There are still two more discussion sessions. And, you know, so we save a lot of this for discussion as well. Let's thank the speaker.